Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's May the 28th, 2015. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Right, I do remember my promise from last week to get more into detail on the specific areas of the homeland and the nuts and bolts of migration, and we'll get into that, but I tell you what. Let's start out this week on a lighter note with another installment of Quies Custodiat Ipsos Custodes, Who Guards the Guardians? A segment of this show dedicated to the proposition that the dictator's musclemen are fools, cowards, and a general disgrace to humanity. Well, they are. Now, this week, we have examples from not one, not two, but three, count them, three, of our fine federal law enforcement agencies. What a bunch of maroons.
There's a man who leads a life of danger. Everyone he meets, he stays a stranger. Read every move he makes, another chance he takes. Odds are he won't live to see tomorrow. Secret Agent Man, Secret Agent Man, they've given you a number and taken away your name.
First off, what in God's name is going on with the United States Secret Service? It's gotten to the point where keeping up with that agency's screw-ups is almost a full-time job. Guarding Barry and Michelle Mybelle in the White House must be like living in a Porky's movie. The President of the United States is being protected, if that's the word, by a bunch of drunken buffoons and sex maniacs. First off, last month, a Secret Service agent named Arthur Baldwin, in this case assigned to the Foreign Missions Branch, was arrested on a felony charge of first-degree attempted burglary and the destruction of property in Washington, D.C. There were a couple of articles about this that I was able to find on the net, and apparently he was trying to break into the apartment of his ex-wife. No indication of the race of this particular agent, and it's almost impossible to locate a verifiable photograph of any federal law enforcement agent on the internet unless they're testifying in front of Congress or something and they can't evade the limelight. Yeah, they have that privilege. I think there must be some kind of arrangement with Google. Anyway, not too much more I can find on this case. It's dropped off the media radar and probably won't return, so we'll probably never know what happened there. Also, last month, a high-ranking supervisor was suspended after a female agent alleged that he sexually assaulted her after hours at agency headquarters. Now, this one's a beaner. 48-year-old Javier Morales, who was placed on administrative leave and had his security clearance suspended after, quote-unquote, allegations of misconduct and potential criminal activity. He has been banned from entering the White House or any Secret Service office, and he's had his gun and badge taken away. Oh, gee, now he's just like everybody else with no special privileges. That must be devastating to a Fed, to be demoted to be just one of us norms. The female agent claimed that Morales, a manager in the agency's security clearance division and her own boss, made quote-unquote unwanted advances toward her after they returned to headquarters from a party at a Washington restaurant March 31st. The party was held to celebrate Morales' assignment to head the Secret Service field office in Louisville. The race of the woman is not identified, but I think we can all guess that she was white. Apparently, it was not an actual rape, possibly because Special Agent Morales was too drunk to follow through. There is no record of whether the female agent went all Buffy the Vampire Slayer on her boss and defended herself with flashy kickboxing and kung fu like a good feminist warrior princess should. Although I'm sure some politically correct urban legend to that effect will eventually spring up and start going the rounds of the email trees in D.C. Democrat circles and possibly get this female agent a job with the Hillary Clinton campaign. Like I said, there's no real details that have been made available, but basically what she seems to have done, in fact, didn't involve kung fu or a long feminist consciousness-raising speech on No Means No. Instead, she seems to have fled from the office and then reported him in the morning and not come back herself until Morales was banned from the building, which, if he did try to rape her, is perfectly understandable. The rather extreme reaction of the agency tends to indicate to me that this probably wasn't Morales' first rodeo of this kind of behavior. Or maybe the Secret Service is just especially paranoid these days, what with all the underage prostitutes and drunken agents passed out in the White House corridors and running over suspicious packages outside the White House while driving drunk and that kind of thing. Now, this greaseball apparently couldn't remember that under the dictatorship he serves, he's expected to be as chaste as a monk, except within certain very limited politically correct parameters. And like everything else governmental, male federal employees have to follow the protocols and procedures if they want to get some. Unless he's a transgender faggot, of course, and then he can get it on in the Lincoln bedroom with the White House dog if he wants, and none shall say him nay. I always find it amusing when this regime tries to impose these new counterintuitive and unnatural racial and sexual rules of society on other people, and they find they can't do it without requiring big, strong, macho men to use physical force, up to and including guns and prison, in order to make all us mere peasant white boys and everybody else toe the line. But who keeps the same big, strong men wearing federal badges in line? Who does guard the guardians? Especially the big apes who are black or brown and who don't have the required genetic development in the moral faculties of their more primitive minds to understand and accept that liberals and Jews are just so much more wise and worthy than they are, and that so-called progressives are superior beings who are just so entitled to tell other people how to live their lives, including them. The dictator's muscle men in the alphabet soup agencies force the rest of us to bow down low to Barry and his mulatto women and his little Jewish friends. But who forces them to bow down low and burn their own pinch of incense on the altar of the false progressive gods? Now, in this case, it's the D.C. Metro Police Sex Crimes Unit who are investigating the case. Quis custodiat ipsos custodes indeed. Interestingly, this Morales meaner was among the first group of officials that the new Secret Service director, a guy named Clancy, promoted when he took over as acting director in October, after that politically correct affirmative action female director they had was finally forced to resign when too many agents were caught acting drunk and stupid. Oh, one more thing. Quote from the Washington Post, "The security clearance division Morales helped oversee is responsible for determining when agents, through misconduct or other actions, have jeopardized their security clearances and should lose their jobs. It also helps vet Secret Service job applicants for potential security issues." Last year, Morales was president of the Hispanic American Police Command Officers Association, a national law enforcement group that has had several prominent Secret Service agents as leading members. Okay, say goodbye to that story now. It's disappeared into the woodwork, and I very much doubt we'll ever hear how it turns out. Moving right along now to those gallant boys and girls of that fine, upstanding, and utterly incorruptible bastion of federal law enforcement, the Drug Enforcement Agency. On March 25th, one DEA agent and one Secret Service agent, Secret Service again, were charged with wire fraud, money laundering, and related offenses for stealing digital currency, i.e. bitcoins, during their investigation of the Silk Road, which, for those of you who don't remember, was an underground black market that allowed users to conduct illegal transactions like dope deals and whatnot over the internet. I always wondered how those people thought they could get away with something that blatant, but apparently they did for a long while. Special Agent Carl M. Force of the Drug Enforcement Agency and Special Agent Sean W. Bridges of, you guessed it, the United States Secret Service, were both assigned to the Baltimore Silk Road Task Force, which investigated the Silk Road Internet Marketplace. Force was an undercover agent who was tasked with establishing communications with a target of the investigation, a guy named Ross Ulbricht, who was also known as Dread Pirate Roberts. Force is charged with wire fraud, theft of government property, money laundering, and conflict of interest. Bridges, the Secret Service guy, is charged with wire fraud and money laundering. During the investigation, Force engaged in, quote-unquote, certain authorized undercover operations with Dread Pirate Roberts as part of the sting, and apparently while he was doing so, he decided to turn a few extra bucks on the side himself and engaged in certain unauthorized undercover activities, including using faked online IDs on the Silk Road to engage in all kinds of complex Bitcoin transactions, in which he managed to steal from the government and also from the cyber criminals on the Silk Road itself, who were the targets of the investigation. He was not only investigating these guys, he was robbing them. Force received bitcoins as part of the official investigation, but he failed to report some or all of his receipts, and instead he transferred the bitcoins to his personal account. In one such transaction, Force allegedly sold information about the government's investigation to the target of the investigation, so he's ratting out his own kind. Another illustration of the problem all dictatorships face in hiring men like this to do their dirty work for money. When someone comes along who can offer them more money, how do you know your hired guns will stay hired, Barry? Anyway, according to news reports, these two crooked feds pocketed something like $800,000 between them before they got caught. To add insult to injury, when the DEA crook did get caught and the badly misnamed Justice Department froze his bank accounts, Force dummied up an online subpoena to unfreeze the account. Online subpoena? My God, have things deteriorated that much in that you can be held legally liable for not reading your email now? Again, folks, say goodbye to this one. The ultimate disposition of this case will be quiet, and in my opinion, there will not be a squeak of it anywhere in the mainstream media. Finally, it's time to hear once again from our friends in the silk suits over at the FBI. The Federal Bureau of Investigation and the U.S. Justice Department admitted in April that over 2,500 people were falsely convicted. 32 people were sentenced to death, and 14 people were wrongfully executed as a result of systematic perjury by FBI forensics experts over a period of as long as 40 years. Oops! According to numerous exposés, my immediate source being the Washington Post, from the 1970s until 2012, the FBI laboratory and the forensics unit routinely ordered its agents to commit perjury regarding hair and bite mark analysis in federal courts, falsely testifying that hair and bite matches that were not certain were certain. 26 of the 28 examiners in the microscopic hair comparison unit have been implicated in the serial perjury. These 26 are said to have testified falsely in more than 95% of the cases where they appeared in federal court. Their cases involved 46 states and the District of Columbia. Jesus Christ. Let's stop and think about this for a minute, about the implications of this. Now, when I did my Who Guards the Guardians expose on this show a few months ago, even I had no idea how bad it was. Now it's come out, and the story has already basically disappeared from the news cycle, as if this massive horror never happened. Now, can there be any doubt now that Edgar Steele was imprisoned on FBI fabricated evidence and FBI perjury until he was murdered last year in his cell? Oh, sorry, extrajudicially executed. Can there be any doubt now that Bill White is completely innocent? Of course White's innocent in a larger sense, in that even if he did what he's accused of doing, sending irate emails and making politically incorrect Facebook posts that the ruling party doesn't like aren't supposed to be crimes in this country. The next time any of these people in their suits and late model SUVs show up on your doorstep and flip their badges and demand to come into your home and ask you questions that will help them destroy the lives of others, and maybe yours as well, remember who you have in front of you. Drunks. Cowards who shot men like John Dillinger and Pretty Boy Floyd in the back, and whose descendants burned children alive in Waco, shot a mother holding her infant child in a doorway in Ruby Ridge, and pumped 7 bullets into a man lying on the floor of his apartment in Florida because he either wouldn't tell them what he knew or else he knew too much. Liars and perjurers. Vicious little sneaks who fabricate audio files with which to murder 68-year-old men. Sexual psychopaths who go for underage prostitutes in Colombia and who try to rape their co-workers. Human reptiles without any moral sense who commit acts of violence, dishonesty, treachery, and wickedness for money and medical insurance. Those people standing on your doorstep, shoving their stupid little badges in your face and arrogantly demanding entry into your home because they think themselves so much better than you are not. No matter what your faults, you are the better human being than anyone who carries one of those badges. Ask them if they have a warrant. If they do not, then tell them you have nothing to say and close the door in their faces.
Secret.
This is Sparky and Rhonda Rucker.
I'm a good old rebel, now that's just what I am. For this fair land of freedom, I do not care a damn. I'm glad I fought against it, I only wished we'd won. And I don't want no pardon for anything I've done. I hate the Constitution, this great republic too. I hate the Freedmen's Bureau and their uniforms of blue. I hate that nasty ego with all its brags and fuss. Them lying, thieving Yankees, I hate of wuss and wuss. I hate the Yankee Nation and everything they do. I hate the Declaration of Independence too. I hate their glorious Union, 'tis dripping with our blood. I hate their striped banner, I've fought it all I could. I followed old Marsh Robert for 4 years near about. I got wounded in 3 places and starved at Pint Lookout. I caught the rheumatism at camping in the snow. But I killed a chance of Yankees, I'd like to kill some more. $300,000 Yankees is stiffened southern dust. We got 300,000 before they conquered us. They died of southern fever, southern steel and shot. And I wished it was 3 million instead of what we got. Well, I can't take up my musket and fight 'em now no more. But I ain't gonna love 'em now, that's for certain sure. And I don't want no pardon for what I was and am. And I won't be reconstructed, and I don't give a damn.
Next up, we have a couple of contributors whom I will not name for the reason that it might be actually physically dangerous for me to do so. We're going to hear from a couple of our younger comrades, one from Great Britain and one from Canada, young men who seem to be discovering their political and racial roots as most of us did in our younger days, which is always an interesting process to follow. While the stuff they're saying may sound a little basic to some of us, the fact that they're saying it at all is something of a minor miracle. because if either of these guys were to be detected saying these things by the police in their own country, they would be looking at criminal prosecution and most likely prison time, simply for daring to think such thoughts and daring to speak them out loud where their words might be heard by others and give other pale people ideas. In Britain, I believe the standard sentence for anyone who dares to utter so much as a syllable of what this young Englishman is going to say here is 7 years in prison. Used to be 5, but apparently the regime over there in Airstrip 1 didn't think that was sufficiently a deterrent to us pale ones who might harbor rebellious thoughts. Oh, by the way, they might give this man a sentencing enhancement if they thought he was attempting to radicalize youth, which is now a crime over there in Old Blighty. In Canada, this second young man, if he's identified by the authorities, has to look forward to a charming little number called a human rights tribunal, which is a special court that is not a court, which has all the power of a court to ruin lives and impose fines and whatnot, but none of the legal procedures and protections of a court and the power to send people to prison for disobeying it. Guess who sits on these abominable things? Anyway, if these guys have the courage to speak and take that kind of risk, we have the duty to listen.
The Modern Bolshevist and How to Defeat Him by Fuhrer Prinzip. Introduction. We need only kick in the door and the whole rotten structure will come crashing down. Adolf Hitler, Fuhrer und Reichskanzler, Oberbefehlshaber der Wehrmacht. What is modern Bolshevism? And moreover, why am I using what appears quite frankly an archaic term for an ideology which was apparently defeated in 1991 with the dissolution of the Soviet Union? The end to the criminal failures of the CCCP and the humiliation of the historically noble Slavic peasantry has been a welcome relief to the Russian people. They have since thrown off the shackles of both communism and capitalism and are adopting a new, exciting approach under their seemingly unshakable leader Putin, whom for the time being is secure. But what does this mean for us National Socialists and our constant fight against Marxism and its ideals? If we have no state to target, where do we place our hatred? Into what body do we exact revenge for the terrible crimes committed by Bolshevism and by the USSR? And how do we recognize the modern Bolshevist, whom now adopts so many personas, disguises, and social groups that he manipulates everything towards the eventual goal of global spanning communism? Lastly, certainly not of little importance, why do I find it necessary to use the term Bolshevist? During the course of this short essay, I intend to answer these questions, and in conclusion, will attempt to provide the case for simply calling our hated enemies Bolsheviks. For, ultimately, Marxism has now adopted so many sub-forms that it is impossible to simply address it so, and we must find better terminology than the Reds, the Lefties, or the liberal loony left, as these are no longer suitable. Part 2. No state, no target. How does the loyal and brave National Socialist identify his enemies in one cohesive grouping if they have no state? It is simple for the working-class man over a pint to say, these idiot lefties have done such and such, their abstract policies have ruined this country, and as such, etc., etc. But the sum of the term lefties does not encompass the problem, nor does it wholly surround our enemies in one simple term. Many leftists will openly champion ideals which were dissident in the USSR, or that are contrary to some principles of the Bolshevist ideology. Then you are presumably asking, why call them Bolshevists? Because they challenge some Bolshevist principles, but not all. Bolshevism brought to its most basic points is Marxist-Leninism. The two prophets of international Jewry who brought forth their cancerous ideology to the world and refined it sufficiently to make it a worldwide worldview, both Marx and Lenin championed the idea of personal freedom and liberty within the state. This, of course, includes homosexuality of all kinds. Lenin even encouraged it among his followers. And he, in that respect, revealed to the world the true dangers of Bolshevism and its ideological degeneracy. Thus, LGBT campaigners can, with justification, be grouped into this Bolshevist terminology. Bolshevism without a state is still Bolshevism, of course. And if we group our opponents into one simple catchphrase, which has history to back it up, we do justice in finally ending the debate as to what we wish to address our vile foes with. Many of our comrades, in a less intellectual approach, will of course focus instead on simply insulting our enemies. This is of course not sufficient. Just as the term Nazi is now used as a derogatory synonym for National Socialist, we must use Bolshevist as a term to simultaneously identify and insult our enemy, just as they use Nazi to insult our national comrades. In this day and age, when Bolshevist cretins have perfected the use of buzzwords, of catchphrases, and of political slogans, we are falling behind. It is no longer acceptable to simply repeat, like a cracked record, the lefties, liberals, and loonies synonyms for identification. Instead, it is now vital, absolutely vital, that we move on and re-establish a term the Führer accurately used to encompass all of his enemies. For example, Judeo-Bolshevism is now a universally accepted ideological enemy, and yet it is unnecessary because we as a folk already recognize the fact that our enemy is led by Bolshevist Jews in every aspect of life. Their politics, culture, and art is ultimately led by the Jews. Thus, it is pointless to use the term Judeo-Bolshevism when we already acknowledge that the first element controls the latter. Considering this, one might be encouraged to say, well, why don't we simply call them Jews? Because this does not address the problem at all. The Jews are the poison which influences these individuals. If one wanted to take that route, it would be simply confused and silly. We would end up addressing them as Judeo-influenced persons, which naturally will not be accepted by the Voreb, who have no interest in a phrase which requires effort to say. Further still, in speeches and in public rallies, it will appear and sound awful and look, naturally, rather idiotic. Such a large phrase is unnecessary. Like the left, we must learn to master these buzzwords which they use to manipulate our folk so well. It is critical that we take on the same attitude to politics and begin to retake the minds of our fellow comrades. Thus, without a state to target and many divergent left-wing groups to destroy, we must reinstitute a term which has, up until 1945, been used to accurately describe our enemies. The word carries weight, history, and has the blessing of the Führer. Thus, I propose we use one simple term for our enemies. Bolshevists. Part 3. Why Bolshevists? It is important at this point to reflect on the history of the word itself. The connotations of Bolshevism are disgusting. The history of the failed Bolshevist states, including the USSR, North Korea, and now China, provides us with sufficient cause enough to finally use this term to accurately address our hated and despised enemy, whom, at the present, under a plethora of terms, seems to be expanding mass of groups with varying interests. And yet, at the heart of this amorphous mess of differing ideological standpoints, stands the Jew and his ultimate interest. Firstly, the annihilation of the white race wholly and utterly, and secondly, the establishment of a global communist state to finally put an end to mankind as anything other than a slave race dedicated to the Jews in every way. Their overwhelming of the National Socialist State, the destruction of Berlin and other cultural monuments of the Aryan race, their desecration of both living and dead, indicates that no other term is more appropriate than Bolshevist to reckon with this beastly foe. Many white nationalists will inevitably remark that I am simply playing to a time of the past, of pitched street battles between the Sturmabteilung and the Red Front. This is, of course, not the situation. I wish to bring the term Bolshevist into this contemporary period, wherein we face an enemy with no direct term to describe them with and no mode of address which is simultaneously a descriptor and an insult. They call us Nazis because it is to them an insult. To most brainwashed white men and women, being called a Nazi is an obvious smear. An insult of such intensity that it causes the poor person on the receiving end of such an attack to be a social pariah. On the other hand, a far larger number of people will openly support communism. In many cases, I have seen students waving the red flag, wearing Bolshevist pins and badges, at the same time, of course, as equal rights and LGBT insignia. One might say that these are isolated incidents, but I firmly disagree. It is of great necessity to recognize this enemy with his varying goals, ultimately becomes one in the bosom of international Jewry. To remind the reader, the National Socialist Reich, in the words of the Führer, was forced to fight the war because of international Jewry and its helpers. Are we to describe these assistants of satanic Jewry as helpers? Most certainly not. That will not resonate within the mind of the folk, it will seem absurd. Therefore, we must concentrate our actions against the term Bolshevism. And then, once we are all agreed, a storm so ferocious must be unleashed that it forces the folk to realize being called a Bolshevik is truly the ultimate insult, and clearly denotes the individual called so as an utterly insane and diseased creature. Part 4. Outward divisions, inward unity. The suggestion that the term does not fit because many of our foe have varying end goals is absurd. Those of us with faith in the lessons the Kampfzeit has taught us will recognize how outwardly divided the Bolshevist movement appears. It receives its proverbial marching orders directly from the Jews. In every way, the Bolshevist movement, which encompasses so much and yet apparently is so divided, is arguably stronger in unity than our sacred cause. Why? Movements controlled and influenced by international Jewry. 1. Lesbian, gay, bisexual, transsexual, etc., etc. rights. 2. Feminism, intersectional feminism, and all variants of feminism. 3. Communism, Marxism, Leninism, and all types of socialism. 4. All trades union movements. 5. Nudist movements. 6. Expressive, abstract art, and the artists associated with said works. 7. Black nationalism, the Black Panthers, etc. 8. The pro-drugs movement. 9. The pro-choice movement. 10. Press groups such as the Huffington Post, the Daily Mirror, etc. 11. Campaigns that promote humanism. 12. Campaigns for aid to third world countries. 13. Any pro-Israel lobby.
The Jewish holy book, the Talmud, says, "The Jews are called human beings, but the non-Jews are not humans, they are beasts." I once did a segment on the importance of the nuclear family before. However, I decided to do a radio segment on the Jews. Since the earliest days of Judaism to the 21st century, they have slithered their way into every area of influence, into every nation of the Western world. Their hands have forged constant, unending problems for the white race. It is from the hand of the Jew, which wrote the Communist Manifesto, and the hands of the Jew that which have gripped the grip on our financial institutions. It is they whom have stood in our way since the very beginning of civilization. Whoever possesses a mild form of critical thinking skills and a basic knowledge of history of the Jews can see that they are not the victim to which they always claim to be. They are not always forced into the financial institutions as so many people claim. They have always conglomerated into the financial centers of commerce, whether it be Alexandria, Rome, and the various Germanic kingdoms throughout the Holy Roman Empire during the medieval time. While it is true to a degree that we did not force them into financial situations, the truth of the matter is that we did encourage it. We encourage it because the banking requires a twisted set of morals, a twisted set of morals that cannot be found in Christianity. Instead, the Jews and their Talmudic belief system is founded upon the belief that anyone who is not a part of the Jewish race is not a person, and therefore can be treated like animals. The Jews have no problem taking advantage of their control of the financial institution, willingly lending money they knew kingdoms could not pay back in order to gain political control, or lending more money than what they knew a prince could pay back in order to blackmail him with that fact. Eventually, they would always went too far and held their grip far too tight, and they were always expelled, whether it's setting interest rates up to over 60% per week on loans, or being too public with their hold over the prince or king, and the people would rise up and kill any Jew they got their hands on. They would always slither their way back, however, mostly with a new regime came into power, and that regime needed money to fund their plans or wars. They welcomed the Jew with open arms, and Jew gladly accepted and always held a dagger in their hand. Their influence and dominations of banking held a monopoly over the institutions well into the end of the 20th century. Only now in the 21st century have they felt any resistance to their monopoly on banking and financial institutions. The ironic thing is that they have begun to meet their end to the very thing which they have helped create and spread. Liberalism. Liberal fashion is against Israel, and with the power of liberalism in full force, they find themselves in increasingly rocky positions. Though make no mistake, their influence and power is no doubt vast, just not as vast as it once was. The Jews' influence can be seen in all its power during the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. The Jews' influence within the British government is what led to the creation of the Balfour Declaration after all, which forged the modern state of Israel, or at the very least, its foundation. We can also see during this time the Jews' creation of the USSR and toppling of the Tsarist Russia. Vladimir Lenin and Leon Trotsky and a majority of all the high command of the USSR's government were indeed Jewish. It was Stalin's right-hand man, who was also a Jew, who forged a death warrant to over 11 million Ukrainians via starvation due to food confiscations during the 1930s and 40s, as we know today as the Holodomor. Harry Hopkins, a man born from Hungarian Jewish parents, was Franklin Roosevelt's closest advisor, who was the head architect of the Roosevelt's New Deal and can be attributed to influencing Franklin Roosevelt into the Lend-Lease Agreement, which was the first step of American intervention in the Second World War against Nazi Germany and Japan. Why can they hold such influence? Why have they survived, despite angering every nation in history due to their crimes against them? Well, nations in the Western world, at the very least. The answer is that it is due to their racial religion. It says in the Talmud that anyone who breeds with a non-Jew is corrupted and should be shunned. So-called Jewish ghettos found all throughout Europe, throughout the ages, were the creation of the Jews themselves in order to actually separate themselves from the other non-Jews. This is why there are so much genetic diseases found within European Jewish genetics. It is largely due to inbreeding. Their ugliness, their twisted set facial features is all due to this actual inbreeding. Comical enough. The race-based religion is what kept them afloat for thousands of years, and is bred into them, a parasitic state of mind. Therefore, the Jewish question that arose in the 1800s was how we can stop them from conducting their parasitic activities. The solution, of course, was the forced removal from the countries for which they inhabit. All else was tried, from the Spanish attempts at forced conversion to the Germanic state's attempts at forcing them into the agriculture sector. In conclusion, the influence of the Jews has been parasitic, the antithesis of all white civilization. Well, this has been my segment on the Jews. The Northwest Republic prevails, comrades.
All right, the group is called No Fear. The song is called Victory Day.
This world has no life to give. Times are soon to change.
Greetings, comrades. This is the trucker coming at you from Iowa, headed out to California with a load from Pennsylvania. And it's the day after Mount St. Helens Day, May 19th. And for those of you planning your migration, you need to plan it rather carefully. Old Man Winter is hanging on out here in the Rockies. I just had my weather radar app up on my laptop here a couple hours ago, and I see it's snowing, that four-letter word, there in Colorado and southern Wyoming. So, yeah, I-80 might be a little bit interesting come tomorrow when I get to it. So those of you that are getting ready to migrate out this way, just be aware that it might be nice and warm over there in Pennsylvania like I was yesterday, 80 degrees, but here in Iowa it's 47 degrees and windy, and if it's snowing, you know, it's close to or below freezing over there in Colorado and Wyoming. They've got a good, like I say, storm front going there, so just be aware that you need to go and remember that the Rockies are their own little weather center, and they can present quite a bit of a challenge sometimes when you're trying to cross them. You just never know when it's going to be snowing. So, anyway, that's my little tidbit for the day, so hope to see you all migrating out here to the homeland soon. And carry on, comrades, and we'll see you out on the road. This is the trucker signing off.
Okay, back to migration, like I promised from last week. Once again, I'll do what I can to try and hold you guys' hands and walk you through it, although people, no kidding, Northwest migration is really not that hard. Oh, yes, it's hard in the sense that physical effort and some personal discomfort is required, and like I commented last week, Bill White nailed it in that respect. Americans don't do personal discomfort. You may remember something that Gretchen said a few weeks ago when she was reviewing one of Arthur Kemp's books. Kemp sardonically defined a white South African as someone who would rather be murdered in their bed than make a bed. You might say that a white American is someone who would rather be murdered on his sofa in front of his TV by black or brown home invaders than load his TV and his sofa onto a moving van. Okay, I'm going to ramble a bit now, but this isn't just Grandpa Simpson mumblings. All this stuff I'm going to say here is pertinent to Northwest migration. Just bear with me. Now, you guys who are going to be migrating to the Northwest, don't worry, you're not alone. Millions of our people are fleeing from the American cesspool every year, and you need to understand that there is nothing shameful about that term, fleeing, because that is what people do in order to survive when they're confronted by a cataclysm which is not survivable otherwise. Now, I know I used to say that when you migrate to the Northwest, you're not running away from anything, you're running to something, and right now the party is desperately trying to turn that into the truth, as you people who receive the organizational letters know. But for the time being, we have to get out of our heads this idea that there is anything shameful about surviving, about doing what we have to do in order to survive. We cannot secure the existence of our people and a future for white children if we're lying on a bed in our own urine and feces at the age of 87 in some state-run nursing home in New Jersey, staffed by third-world immigrants who starve and torture the elderly white people they're supposed to be caring for. We cannot secure the existence of our people and a future for white children murdered in our living rooms in Cincinnati, or lying bleeding on the sidewalk outside our houses, where we're the last white resident in some crumbling neighborhood in Tampa, St. Pete, or as we lie dying on a gurney in a sweltering hospital emergency room swamped with Mexicans in Houston, surrounded by blowflies and the gabble of pigeon Spanish. There is nothing shameful about fleeing to avoid that fate. It's what refugees do, and white people are now refugees in our own land. For the next couple of generations, as our numbers dwindle, white people are going to become more and more open about their desire to flee from contact with diversity. Even today, it's understood, sub rosa, that diversity avoidance is the reason for a lot of social and economic things that white people do. It's so common that we can almost, but not quite, talk about it in public. Not quite yet. Give it another decade, and I think we'll be able to be honest with ourselves and others about our motivations, because the system will have deteriorated to the point where it can no longer effectively punish thought and speech, and won't do so anyway because they can't arrest and imprison the very people who are keeping them in power in the Soylent Green world with their technical and administrative skills. Now, for all the population explosion of non-whites, and as terrible as the demographics look on paper, the fact is that the bulk of the problem is and will largely remain in the cities, where the multifarious non-whites have an infrastructure and support system in place through the Democratic Party's welfare state. The cities will be the focal point of left liberal power, the countryside, the last refuge of white people. If you subtract the top 100 metropolitan and urban areas of the United States from the mix, then the racial numbers look a lot better. Flyover country outside the cities is still majority white, although I have to admit that there is probably no place left on the continent that doesn't have at least a few Mexicans who've skittered in like cockroaches to take the lowest level manual labor jobs, which, to be fair, the liberals are right, and white people, as a rule, won't do. And that's what the labor service in the Northwest Republic will be for, as I've spoken of in my novels. Eventually, all that manual labor will be done by young white men and women as part of their national service. Now, that's the big difference between this country and Europe. Here, we still have an immense amount of open space left so that there's always somewhere remaining for the white man to flee. It's true that even the city suburbs in most urban areas are no longer physically safe in many metropoli such as Atlanta, St. Louis, Cincinnati, Baltimore, so forth and so on. According to what I see on the net, right now the tendency seems to be for white people to flee to what are becoming known as exurbs. Now keep an eye out for that word. You're going to be hearing it a lot. These aren't so much towns way, way, way out of the boonies like Devil's Outhouse, Montana or Lizard Lick, North Carolina, which is a real place, by the way. These are farming communities 60 or 70 miles outside Atlanta and St. Louis and Cleveland in the farthest Chicago ring suburbs, so forth and so on. The powers that be seem to be in the process of selecting these little farming towns of 10,000 people or so, where all of a sudden developers are descending on the place and buying up all the farmland. Crucially, the big IT companies are coming into town, and they're building cell towers and laying cable for serious high-speed internet communication so that the yuppies can telecommute to the cities, and plans are being made to build huge shopping malls and bring in major grocery store chains with big fancy deli sections to cater to an influx of six-figure-a-year people who are going to be living in all those renovated farmhouses and all those condos that are going to be springing up. And, of course, the big harbinger of things to come is the appearance of a Starbucks. All this is made possible by telecommuting and by the continued availability of reasonably cheap fossil fuel, specifically diesel for the 18-wheelers that will keep the exurban grocery stores and the shopping malls stocked so that the yuppies don't ever have to physically go into the dangerous non-white cities and expose their precious lily-white skins to black and brown violence and chaos. Now, that is, of course, a weakness in this permanent white flight strategy. The technology and the electronics have to stay up and running, and the diesel fuel for the delivery trucks has to stay cheap or at least available. Now, if those support systems fail, the whole system goes down for real. But so long as those two conditions obtain, this pattern can continue almost indefinitely with the decreasing number of white professionals and techies who keep the machines going, like H.G. Wells' Morlocks in the world of Soylent Green, moving further and further out all the time from the cities in order to keep themselves functioning and to keep physically safe.
Season ticket on a one-way ride, asking nothing.
Okay, time to drag myself kicking and screaming back to the subject of Northwest migration. I've already stated that many of you, when you come here, being low-skilled, if not quite t-shirt youth necessarily, and you're coming home on spec, as it were, with no place to live and no job waiting, are going to have to arrive in the cities, the Pugetopolis, the Portland area, or Spokane or Boise, because that's where the jobs are. Because of the Northwest's still primarily white population, the pattern of exurban flight that I mentioned above has not started to occur here yet, although it seems to be accelerating to full throttle in the rest of the country. Now that means that for the time being, you can still settle down and have a pretty good life in a Seattle or Portland suburb, some of them anyway. What it will be like 20 years from now is another matter. Seattle still has a lot of good areas, but I was here for the first time 20 years ago myself, and the racial and demographic deterioration is noticeable. I used to consider downtown Seattle to be livable, unique in an American city, no more. The further you get away from the center of the city, which is the Democrat power base, and from the black and brown ghetto areas like Rainier Valley in Seattle or the King District in northeast Portland, the nicer it gets. Depending on how long a daily commute you can handle, it is still possible to have a decent life here and say that you live in Seattle or Portland. Now, that's almost unknown in the rest of America. But, long term, if I fail in conveying to our people any sense of urgency about this, if the Northwest migration message is heard among white people but is simply ignored, if I fail in convincing that vitally necessary first 1,000 people to join the party, or at least the NPA, and pay regular dues so that our efforts simply perish of thirst while parched for life-giving funds, if I keel over and whatever I build collapses into squabbling and lawsuits like the National Alliance, if I am disappeared by the legal system like they did Bill White, if any one of a number of bad things were to happen, how do we secure the existence of our people and the future for white children? We plan for that. Now, what I would like to see long term is a series of white nationalist communities all throughout the Northwest homeland, strategically located in small to medium communities around the Northwest, places like Centralia, Washington, Longview, Washington, Ellensburg and Pullman, Washington, Astoria, Oregon, Bend, Medford, and Corvallis, Oregon, Moscow, Pocatello, Post Falls, and Idaho, as well as Coeur d'Alene and Sandpoint, Kalispell, Missoula, and Helena in Montana. Now, don't get me wrong. Politically, we're going to need strong NF units in Seattle and Portland and Spokane, sure. But I think that, like most white people, our long-term future in this new country of ours will lie not so much in the countryside as in the endless plains and fields of wheat or alfalfa, so forth and so on, as in the last remnants of the true small-town America, which is the environment wherein our people seem best to flourish and thrive. No, I don't mean building a beaver Cleaverville, Idaho. We cannot revive or resuscitate the past, and we certainly can't do anything while the present United States regime remains in power. I'm talking about looking towards our future as an independent nation and planning for that as best we can through the optimum distribution of our human resources. So, when you're planning your migration, if you have skills, a cut or two above, flipping burgers or pushing broom, and if you have any assets at all, don't be afraid to check out small town Northwest, especially if you have children young enough to where you want to watch them grow up in health and safety. Right now, there's no better place remaining anywhere on this continent for that. But for now, our time is up for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.